Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. One of our favorite guests is back with us today. He's novelist Carl Hiaasen. Hiaasen's been writing hilarious farces about crime in South Florida since the early 1980s. His novels are filled with his deadpan take on the oddball characters and garish culture he grew up with in his native state. Just to give you an idea about Hiaasen's warped sense of humor, the last time he visited the Two-Way Street studio, he was here to talk about his book Bad Monkey. That novel opened with a tourist on a fishing boat reeling in a severed arm, which leads the captain of the charter to remark to the horrified fisherman, "Well, son, we're in the memory-making business." Hiaasen is back today to talk about his new book, Razor Girl. It's great to have you back, Carl.
Yeah, it's so fun to come back. Thanks for having me back, too. It means a lot.
Razor Girl, the title of the book, refers to a character who we're going to meet really in the opening pages of the book.
Yes.
And her real name is Mary Mansfield. Why is she called Razor Girl?
Oh, well, she is a scammer in a sense that she drives cars and crashes into people on purpose, and which is a cottage industry in South Florida for the insurance scam. But in her case, she does it with a flourish because she's targeting certain men that she's been hired to sort of distract, and she does distract them because while she's driving, she's conducting some personal grooming with a razor so that when they get out of their car to scream at her for crashing into them, they are instantly, you know, being men, go from being outraged to smitten. In the newspaper, because it was this beginning of the book was based on a real episode that happened in South Florida, and we called it that the driver was shaving her bikini area while she was driving, which is a whole separate from texting while driving.
I went searching to see if I could find what I assume. I can't imagine there's more than one example.
No, there's only one I know
of. Okay, so I went searching, and I found this article from keysnews.com,
yes,
right?
Yep.
And I thought the headline was wonderful. FHP, Florida Highway Patrol.
Yes.
Driver lacked razor-sharp focus.
Yes. That's right. That's it.
Florida Highway Patrol troopers say a two-vehicle crash Tuesday at mile marker 21 caused by a 37-year-old woman who was shaving her bikini area while her ex-husband took the wheel from the passenger seat. That sounds like absolutely your kind of fodder.
Yeah, well, I mean, my oldest son was working at the Herald at the time, and of course, anything that comes across the transom that's remotely twisted like that, he emails it to me in about 30 seconds, gleefully saying, "Dad, have you seen this?" And knowing the way my mind works, and he knows I'm going to try to get it into a book. So that's how it ended up on my desk.
The driver's name is Megan Mariah Barnes. Do you have any idea of whether Megan Mariah Barnes knows that you have taken that incident?
I don't know. It was kind of I'm sure it was not a good day for her. She was. She told an FHP trooper she was on her way to a date, yet she's accompanied by her husband, so it might have been one of those Key West romances you read about. But in the novel, it's not really an accident. This happens on purpose, and Mary is a completely different character, of course. And she's pretty smart and pretty funny, and she doesn't consider herself to be really a criminal. But she says at one point, "I'm not just a great driver," because there is a skill in doing those sort of bump crashes. "I'm not just a great driver, I'm a performance artist," because the whole point was that they would send her so that the whoever she hit, the guy that they were chasing, would stop and have a conversation, and the other guys would swoop up and grab him. So that was kind of the way it was working. But she had devised this on her own after reading the article you read. That's how she comes up with the idea. So that's sort of what you do, or you try to do in Florida, or any kind of satire, is you try to take something that really happened and then turn it into something a little, you know, just crank it up a couple of notches.
Yeah, which is something you've been doing in books now, in novels for, this is your 31st novel?
If you'd have to add up everything, I mean, I've got the kids' books and the grown-up books. And it's well over 20, but I purposely don't add them up because it makes me feel creaky and old. But it does span a long period of time, and it also speaks to the amount of material that I have to work with in South Florida, that you could do this sort of thing for 30 years and still get have fresh stuff to work with.
I want to talk to you a little. Well, certainly I want to talk about the book and some of the wonderful characters, some based on characters based on real life, incidents in the book based on real life, and especially on your somewhat warped sense of humor about South Florida and the goings on in South Florida. You are such a veteran of the talk show circuit. I wonder, when you come in, like any other of our great guests, for me, this is a brand new experience every time. But I'm probably the 40th person who's interviewed you in the last week or so. You can't come into each interview thinking, thank goodness I get a chance to start all over again.
Well, you start with the premise that I think most writers, because what we do is fairly solitary. You know, when you think about what a weird gig it is, you're in a room by yourself trying to write something with the presumption that people actually want to read it. So then you come out, and when you do the book tours, you have to spend a lot of time talking about yourself. And I think most writers are uncomfortable talking about themselves and about the process. But after you've done it for as many, I don't want to say 30 years of doing this, I mean, I'm comfortable with it, especially when I'm, you know, if it's a good interviewer and you know they've read the book and you can tell some funny stories and hear some funny stories, that makes it fun. But if it's somebody, and you know how this business goes, a lot of times you'll get to, if it's a morning drive show in some far-flung place, and these guys have looked at the flap jacket and they've tried to figure out, and they just start asking you questions, you realize they haven't even read the flap jacket.
Yeah, they start out by mispronouncing your last
name. Well,
of course,
but that's a given. But then when you see the glazed look in their eyes, And I, to be fair to them, they're interviewing, you know, I don't know how many people a day on these morning shows that go bap, bap, bap. So, but then it's a grind because, you know, they don't have a clue, and you're trying to summarize the whole book and get excited after, and you're just kind of worn out. Like you say, I've been on the road for a couple of weeks, so at this point you're just saying, oh, you know, spare me from this.
Are you in and out of cities like, say, a presidential candidate or the reporters who cover them in the sense that you can say, well, yeah, I was in Atlanta, sort of.
Right, yeah.
I flew into Hartsfield.
Yeah,
I got into a car.
It's usually one night in and out, less than 24 hours on the ground. So, and then people say, God, you got to go to Atlanta or you get to go to Portland. And you tell them, I didn't see anything. I saw an airport, a hotel room, and a bookstore, and then I was gone. It's just like, I'm sure, like the old rock and roll tours, except without the groupies and the great dope.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, aside from that, it's exactly the same.
Do you have any particularly interesting horror stories about a given interview?
So I've got stories about towns. I don't want to name some people. I mean, I've had events that were dubious. I mean, you know, where you go and you literally you're stuck between hotel. You know, the all the power goes out in your hotel, for instance, and you've got like a 5 a.m. wake up call. I remember being in Toronto one time a few years ago in a lobby. The whole hotel goes out. I'm a little claustrophobic anyway. I think a lot of writers are. So I remember walking down like 20 floors of stairs, and there's candles set up in the lobby, and I'm just lying on a couch trying to get some sleep. And a bunch of young people came in from a night on the town and start beating the crap out of each other in the lobby. Then the police come in, and then one of them takes a punch at the police. Finally, somebody has mercy on me. He says, we got one elevator working. We'll take you back to your room. And he was wrong. It wasn't really working. We got stuck between the floors, and we had to pry it open and literally jump into this area. And he had a flashlight, and he took me back. And I'm thinking, this is, you know, but there's every writer has sort of book tour stories from hell. And, of course, there's interview. I mean, one time, I had to go to Texas, and I was interviewed by Morton Downey Jr., and this was in his kind of sad final phase as incarnate. He had been popular and then not popular, and at this point he was, you know, sort of coasting to the end. And, you know, and of course still you walked into the studio, and it was like a tobacco shed. It just reeked of cigarettes. And, you know, I don't think he had read a word, you know, but you just go in saying, here I am. And he was really just turning it on the mic and turning it off. But you end up with some of those where you just go, okay, this is almost like it just mercifully it'll be over in 5 minutes. But in my case, you know, let's. I'm out talking about a book that's out. So it's not life. It's not Syria. You know, it's not ISIS. It's not Zika. And so, if I how outraged can I really get? Somebody didn't read the book, or they can't pronounce my name, or they didn't get a joke in the book. I mean, they clearly went over their head. All you can do is just kind of, you know, coast through it, because it's not worth getting upset about.
Well, I do want to say, I want to stipulate before I mention this, that you have a wonderful publisher, Knopf.
Yeah.
I mean, you couldn't do better.
No.
I'm sure you respect them and love them. We work with their people all the time. But they, like every other publisher, sends out a list of questions for
I didn't even know this. I swear.
Yeah, but no, that's fine. That's not your part. You're not in the promotion.
No,
you're
God.
Not the publisher. The first question on the Razor Girl, I love this because it includes, there's a very interesting fender bender that kicks off Razor Girl. It actually puts for me.
You know, I did see that, but I thought that was like going on a website or something. I didn't realize that they were sending it to the actual interviewers. Just to show the level of embarrassment by the whole proposition of the first scene. I didn't know. Well, I'm sure it was very helpful to you.
It was. So, all right, look, enough of that. Let's talk about Razor Girl, because it has such wonderful characters in it and such a great story. The lion, New York Times, as Donald Trump would say, said, Hyacinth's opening hits you like the first blast of hot, sticky air on a Florida morning. Knocks you sideways, and it can take a while for you to get your bearings. Actually, they're talking about the openings of many of your books. It's plural. Pretty soon, though, you start to realize that the heat and the craziness it induces just aren't going to let up, so you might as well go with it. Not a bad way to start a review.
No, it wasn't a bad way to start a tour. I mean, they were very kind to me, and you know, you never know with this kind of stuff. I mean, because satire is a tricky thing. Writing any kind of humor is tricky, but I mean, my feeling is always, especially in this year, people are desperate to laugh. And what I've found on the road is that, you know, I over the years I've just got great fans, and they get it. They're laughing for the right reasons. They get the joke. They get the line. They get the context. You're not out to preach. That's the worst thing you can do. You're not out to proselytize. But the whole point of satire is to skewer something, lampoon something, and you hope they get it. It isn't just the cinematic, funny aspect of a scene, but what's really happening.
No,
there.
But you get in your hits. You have a character, for instance, who is peeling an Obama sticker off a car bumper, and what happens?
He has a heart attack during an ice storm because he's feverishly scraping an Obama sticker off his neighbor's Audi. You know, we all have these fantasies of I know what would be a good way to get rid of that guy.
Let's talk about some of the characters.
Sure.
We've already met Mary Mansfield, a.k.a. Razor Girl. She's targeted. She accidentally, because she gets the wrong guy.
She gets the wrong guy, yeah.
She stages the accident that runs her into the back of Lane Coolman's rented car. Who's Lane Coolman, and what's he doing in South Florida? He's an L.A. agent, so
he's
what's
he
doing?
He's an L.A. agent.
There?
He's a Hollywood talent manager, and he's rushing to Key West to sort of babysit a rogue client who's also the star of one of these redneck reality shows.
Bayou Brethren?
Bayou Brethren is the name of the show, and it's about these brothers that live on this high-end rooster farm in the swamps of Louisiana. And, of course, it isn't really there. It's in Pensacola, and they aren't really true Louisiana denizens. They were a bad accordion band in Wisconsin, but they had these great beards, and so they got kind of auditioned for this, and they said, you guys want to be on a redneck reality show? And they're all thinking the next Duck Dynasty, you know, and they said yes. And so they brought in coaches, sort of help them with some what Hollywood perceives as sort of Southern culture. You teach them how to shoot a shotgun, run an ATV, and had a Cajun dialect coach. And next thing you know, it's the number one show in the country. So the star of the show, Buck Nance, who has started to believe his own press clippings and do a little preaching and ranting and politically incorrect joke telling, is sent to Key West to promote the show. And this is, a bad venue for this kind of a show. And he got bad intelligence. And so he gets up in a bar and he says a few things, and he realizes he has made a critical mistake.
Well, and because Lane Kuhlman has now been rear-ended and has been kidnapped by Mary
right.
Mansfield and her partner, he's not there to help Buck
no,
get
Buck's
through
on
this
it.
Appearance.
He's on his own on stage on a bar in Duval Street full of bikers, and he presumes they all share his particular view of politics and culture in America, and he's sadly mistaken, and he ends up being pursued through the streets of Key West in fear for his life, and being a very recognizable public figure, decides to change his appearance radically so that he won't be killed by this pagan mob.
Yeah, and you have a fascinating, I mean, a really fun way of introducing your protagonist, Andrew Yancey, who we met first in Bad Monkey.
Bad Monkey, yeah.
We'll talk about him in a second, but what Buck does is shave his beard off and throw it into a vat of quinoa.
Yeah, he runs into the, he's running through the alleys, he sees a light on, and he ends up in the back of a kitchen, a restaurant, and there's a little, some herb scissors that's sitting there, and he just frantically hacks his beard off, and it falls into this vat of quinoa, and so Buck takes off and disappears, but the owners of the restaurant obviously make an emergency call, and Yancey's a health, restaurant inspector, now health inspector, we call him Roach Patrol, down in Florida, and he gets the code red alert saying, you got to come see what's going on in the back of this restaurant and what is in the quinoa. And so that he gets in his car, and that's how he gets swept up into the story.
Yancey's a great character for you. Did you find at the end of it, first of all, explain, he has been a cop.
He was a good cop.
Great
yeah.
cop. Made a terrible mistake.
He's made several, right. mostly in his personal life.
Yeah, in Bad Monkey.
Bad Monkey, and he's lost his badge because there's an altercation with the husband of a woman that he's having an affair with, and it takes place in front of about 2,000 cruise ship passengers in Key West who all have their cell phones out. And it involves a dustbuster appliance, and it's an unsavory altercation. Yancey loses his job. The sheriff kind of feels sorry for him. Says, "Look, you're off the force, but I got another job for you. You're going to be on the health inspector beat. You're going to be on Roach Patrol, and just be glad you're getting a paycheck." So he's gone from being really hotshot detective to inspecting, you know, restaurants, and which is not an unimportant job, but it is a little bit of a not a lateral move either. Yeah.
Why did you decide you wanted to bring Yancey back for an encore performance?
I've never done it with a right. in terms of a protagonist in consecutive novels. I've got characters that drop in and out of novels that
Skink
I've used.
Skink is a
yeah,
perfect example.
He's not
of that.
In this one, but yeah, he's an example. But to actually have the main mm-hmm. character, I've never done it before. But I sort of felt. I liked him a lot, and at the end of Bad Monkey, he's still sort of, I don't want to give too much away, but he's still sort of stuck. He solved a terrifically important crime and thought he was going to get his badge back, and he didn't.
Why do you like him? What is it about Yancey that appeals to you?
Well,
what kind of person
Well,
do you
I like two things
being?
About the whole set. I like the setting of the Lower Keys in Key West. It's a great place, and it's full of great characters and story ideas. Secondly, I liked his outlook in the sense that here he is in what could have been sort of a humiliating job, but he was trying his best to do a good, honest job as health inspector as well. And I felt I kind of left him in there, and I thought, I got to give him another shot. So I'd never done it before, but when I started, I said, and Razor Girl was my, I said, I'm just going to give him another shot at it and see, give him another real crime to solve or a real mystery to solve. And at the same time, I liked his attitude. He loves the keys the way I do, and little things about it that make it's a sunset in particular, which is, you know, he's got this ongoing battle with this lot next door to him, where somebody's bought it is on a building a big spec house, a McMansion in this tiny little neighborhood, and Yancey's not going to have his little modest view of the sunset anymore, so he's launched sort of a guerrilla campaign on his own. To discourage the building of this house.
Deb and Brock want to build
yeah,
a house.
Yeah, and he's
door.
A personal injury lawyer from Miami.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. By the way, we're not going to give away much of the plot
yeah,
of this
okay,
book, but
yeah.
the characters are so fascinating.
Yeah.
You don't mind talking about
not
them.
Not them at all, no.
Right, so here's what's interesting about what you just said. There are themes in it that you take on throughout your writing that relate to what you see has happened to Florida
right.
over
yeah.
the decades that you've been there. And this theme of development and overdevelopment is a very important part of your thinking about And so the fact that Deb and Brock want to build a McMansion that will block Yancey's view, it's funny, it's interesting, but there's more to it for you.
Well, there is, because I mean, growing up down there, I mean, I've seen it happen, and I've seen wonderful little neighborhoods, working class people could actually afford to live there, turn into places where they couldn't, and they had to leave, and the big houses went up, and people who lived there 3 months out of the year and then disappeared, or was doing it on speculation, big real estate speculation market down there. And what always bothered me about it was, if it was somebody who was coming down to a place like the Keys and really loved it and really couldn't wait to get out on the water and couldn't and loved the nature and the wildlife and bird watching, whatever it was, snorkeling, diving, that was one thing, because they had, at least you could see their heart was in it. But it was when it was just sheer greed. It was just about, this is, we're going to turn this over, we're going to flip this, or we're going to, this is going to be, we need to sink some cash somewhere, we need to get it where they can't take it away from us. And that goes on a lot. So those kinds of folks turn up as targets in the novels all the time. It's interesting, in Florida, if you go along the coast, you'll get to one county and you'll know right away what the zoning laws are, because all of a sudden you're driving along A1A and there's the beach and there's, you can see the water, you can see the dunes. And for the next 5 miles, you see nothing but concrete towers. So you know who's sold out, and you know, and you don't even have to see the road that says, you know, going into this county or that county. You just know by the, you know, you obviously, whoever was in running that zoning board just rolled over.
Let's talk a little bit more about another theme. It's really a part of what we're talking about that we come across in Razor Girl. The real target of Mary Mansfield's deliberate accident was supposed to be Martin Tribeau. Tribeau?
Yes, that's correct.
And,
yeah.
Because he runs a, you call it a, quote, beach renourishment business. What is that all about?
That's a real phrase in Florida. We had to come up with a euphemism for this, but because nature, you know, whether it's a hurricane, a northeaster, whatever it is, it beach erosion goes on constantly in a community. We have 1,200 miles of coastline in Florida. I mean, it's always being eaten away by Mother Nature, and that's precious real estate is what it boils down to. So they panic when the beach starts disappearing, and they hire these companies to come in, and you pay them for a new beach. And they either dredge it up offshore if they can get a permit. It may not look, it's not exactly like your beach, but it, at least on a postcard, it looks like a beach. Or they'll actually barge it in from places like the Bahamas, which will sell beach sand to beach renourishment companies. They'll barge it in and put it on the beach. And it's the greatest gig in the world, because a year from now, that beach is going to be gone again.
Do it all over.
And you
got to
do it. They get another phone call saying, remember that beach you gave us last year? Can you build us another one? And but it's a real industry down there. So Tribeau is he does everything on the cheap. He started this company called Sedimental Journeys, and he provides new beaches, but he doesn't like to pay top dollar for the sand that he's bringing. And so he ends up getting some inferior product. That even has some broken glass in it. And it's from a rock mill out in the West Dade, and he ends up putting it behind a property owned by the mafia, a hotel property owned by the mafia, which realizes that it has been scammed and taken advantage of, because all the people who are staying at the resort are now running up into the lobby with bloody feet, saying, "What is that? That's not a real beach." So they're chasing Tribeau, and basically with they have hired Mary to go find him and stop him, and he's going to either get them a new beach, put in the new beach, or die. That's sort of what happens to him. He's got grand plans, and he enlists the mafia guy who comes down to visit him. Tribeau is always, he's a talker, and he gets the guy psyched up about this whole idea. His idea is to go to Cuba and ask the Castro brothers, would they sell us some of their beaches? And he actually persuades the guy, I think, that this might actually work.
Let's take a break now. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with novelist Carl Hiaasen. His new book is Razor Girl. This is Two Way Street. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. If you're just joining us, my guest is best-selling author Carl Hiaasen. His new book is Razor Girl. It continues his long line of best-selling crime novels set among the oddball characters and garish culture of South Florida, where he grew up. I don't want to go too far in giving away elements of the book, but we do have to talk about the Gambian
pouch rats. Giant Gambian pouch rats.
Excuse me.
That's what they're actually called.
Giant? What are they?
They're a real species. It's the world's largest species of rat. They're obviously from Gambia, and they're Senegal, Morocco, that part of the world. And they grow up to about 9 pounds. Now, that's a big-ass rat, right? But back in the 70s, somebody in the pet trade in America got the idea that what Americans really wanted as pets would be a rat so big you had to put it on a leash. And they started importing these giant Gambian pouch rats. And there was a fellow, the feds finally shut it down, but there was a fellow in the Keys, down in the lower Keys, Grassy Key, who was nothing if not an optimist. He got a whole bunch of them, was breeding a little colony of these giant Gambian pouch rats. And when the word came down, first of all, nobody was buying them. That wasn't too good. It didn't go over big in the pet trade. But then the word came down that the feds said, no more. We can't do this anymore. And he did what all the python owners in Florida do, which is he just opened the cages and said, okay, get out of here, beat it, hit the bricks. And so he turned them loose. And this was ever since then, there have been these sightings around the Keys of, and they're hard to miss. It's a 9-pound rat. It's not like you're going to confuse it with anything else. And so I just thought, for the purposes of giving Yancey a worthy adversary in his health inspector duties, I mean, he's been doing cockroaches and mouse droppings, but go mono on rodent with the world's largest.
Yeah, he's
I
called
so
I to a restaurant.
Introduced them into this novel.
Yeah, he's called to a restaurant.
It's called to a restaurant. Yes, and the owners have vacated the place, and the patrons have fled, even though this is Key West, and the owner was saying, no, that wasn't a rat. That was one of Hemingway's cats. It wasn't one of 8-toed cats. It wasn't. Nobody's buying. It's already on Yelp. It's already on TripAdvisor that there's this giant row. So the owners of the restaurant are frantic, and they don't want to go back in. They send Yancey in to try to solve the Gambian pouch rat problem.
You've been you very graciously told me that you'd be willing to read a couple paragraphs when you can set up what you're about to read for us.
Well, this is right after Yancey goes into the back of this restaurant. He doesn't know what to arm himself with. He's never seen one of these things, but they're legendary, and he knows they're real. And so this is just what his entry into this darkened restaurant where there is obviously something large moving around. After taking a few steps, he heard scurrying above him. He aimed the beam of the Rayovac at the drop ceiling, where pocked tiles quivered under the tread of an unseen commuter. Stillness followed, and Yancey moved forward, poking the handle of the pitchfork at random at overhead panels. A sharp clatter made him whirl toward the bar, his flashlight fixed on wide-set ember eyes glowing behind a tipped green fifth of Tanqueray. It was a well-fed, fully mature Chrysotomus gambianus, nosing the air and flexing its gin-soaked haunches. Drawing closer, Yancey saw that the tawny trespasser had stuffed its springy cheeks with Neil's special gourmet mix, which featured dwarf almonds imported from Catalonia. Yancey heaved the pitchfork javelin style but missed, taking down a row of top-end liquor bottles. The spooked intruder leapt in a full stretch from the bar counter to the wall, where it dangled by two legs from a frame displaying Clippy's treasured 3-star certificate from Michelin. Yancey swung the heavy Rayovac, the blunt end cracking the glass but failing to make contact with the uber vermin, which dropped to the floor, defecated daintily, and dashed away.
Carl Hiaasen reading from his newest novel, Razor Girl. The book is filled with wonderful stories like that, terrific characters, and it's just a great read. I want to talk about presidential if we can for a few minutes. But
speaking of vermin,
okay. Do any of your friends in Florida? Do you? I mean, you hold up to a great deal of derision and satire at what goes on in Florida. Do you find that as you go around Florida, when people know who you are or find out who you are, that Floridians sometimes get pretty irritated with you?
It's funny. I would expect that they do. I mean, I still write the column for the Herald, and it's not, you know, it's got an edge to it, and it certainly makes fun of a lot of what's going on, a lot of who's doing it. But I would expect that. But interesting, it doesn't really happen. I mean, usually the crowd, I mean, when I get up and start telling stories or how I feel, even whether they're Democrats or Republicans, they have to laugh because we're all in it together down there. It is really, you know, this fountain of sleaze and everybody knows it. And you know, they pay me for my opinion at the Miami Herald, not to sit on the fence and go, on the one hand this, on the other hand this. That's not my job. My job is to you know, give an opinion. And so I'm sure that there are people in the crowd that might be grinding their teeth. But for the most part, people are laughing and, okay, and kind
good.
Of nodding their head. I mean,
good.
I say this, knock on wood. I've been doing it a long time. I mean, I some of the mail, you know, when you you get the mail where it's the envelope is written in Crayola, and you can pretty well guess geographically on the postmark where it's coming from. And there's certain pockets of Florida that are, you know, don't have a sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, I just get trolled on Twitter. I think it's amazing you actually still get stuff from the U.S. Postal Service.
I do. I mean, and I have a Twitter account. That, you know, the Miami Herald made all of us get a Twitter account. I
would think you have the potential to be one of the great tweeters. You're capable of being so pithy, so clever. You just don't.
I've only done it about a year.
You're not going to lower yourself?
No, it's
that?
Not that. No? It's that I really don't have a handle on how to do it yet. Also, I don't have iPad or anything. I have got to do it on my cell phone, and and it's hard to read. What I'm usually doing is picking an article or picking something out of the news, and I'll just do like a one-line comment. I won't do a full 144 characters. The other thing is that, you know, I at my age, the great ideas that do occasionally spring into my mind, they're either going to be a column or they're going to be in a book, but I don't want to necessarily
Why give it away?
Waste them on a Twitter. I mean, and I have to say, I don't follow all. I don't have the time. Literally, you know, my day is writing. It's writing all day. There are people, you can use up a whole lot of your day counting up the number of likes you get on some tweet. And I don't get that.
You have referred to at your age, you've used that expression three or four times already in this conversation.
Well, I mean, I've been doing this a long time.
But are you starting to think about getting older and what that means?
Oh, you know, writers are, look, we're neurotic, we're anxious, we're insecure. I mean, I felt old when I was 30. I mean, and also I'm Norwegian, so none of this should surprise you. But I think in terms, here's what I do think, Bill, in terms of, for instance, the column, you know, and I've been with the paper a long, long time, and I keep doing the column because I care about Florida. And also, look, I got family down. As your family grows older, man, I've got grandkids now. I've got people I care about. I want there to be something left of that beautiful place for them. So to the extent that you're thinking in a larger, sort of on a larger canvas, that you're not just some young firebrand reporter, you know, mouthing off, you do have to sort of put it in the context of your own experience, which is, you know, my whole lifetime down there.
We're going to take another break now, but when we come back, we'll talk politics with Carl Hiaasen. Even though he says it dismays him to admit it, his home state of Florida is once again going to be crucial in determining the outcome of this year's presidential race. Two-way street. Let's get back to my conversation with Carl Hiaasen. Before he became a wildly successful novelist, Hiaasen was a general assignment reporter for the Miami Herald, and he continues to write a column for the Herald. So he's well positioned to talk with us about the politics of his state in this crucial election year. So let's talk a little. You're in Florida, which everyone knows is perhaps the most important of the battleground states.
Oh, God, don't say that.
Well, it is. You know that. With that said, what's happening in Florida right now?
Well, I mean, I don't think it, going back even in the 80s, not any of us thought that Florida would ever have the kind of role that has evolved in terms of the Electoral College and being a swing state. And, I mean, every 4 years we go through this anxiety as Floridians. Please don't let it come down to us again. After what happened in 2000, I tell people we feel lucky that they even let us vote after what happened in 2000, that chaos. So every 4 years, we're secretly praying for, let it be Ohio, let it be Pennsylvania, let it be another swing state that decides who is going to be the most powerful leader in the free world. Don't let it be Florida. I mean, but and here's the other fear we have, because if you, this whole Russian hacking thing, right? If you're the Russian hackers, right, and you're sitting in the warehouse where they've got you doing these attacks on American cyber targets, you're looking for a place to hack, and you've got a map of the United States. Where do you think they're going to pick? I mean, they're going to pick a state that screwed up without even any hacking, just screwed up on its own. Florida's going to be the perfect. So we live in this right. fear.
The Russians don't need hanging chads
they
anymore.
They don't need hanging chads. They've got us.
You wrote a column in which you essentially said Donald Trump will never be president of the United States.
But like everyone else, I didn't even think he'd be the Republican nominee. So I was wrong about that. I don't think he's going to be president. I mean, I think, for instance, let's just look at seriously for Florida. A whole lot of people are going to have to stay home for him to win Florida. A whole lot of voters in South Florida, a lot of Hispanic voters, African-American voters, and female voters are going to have to stay home for him to win Florida. And the polls show this tightening and everything else, but they also showed that Obama was going to lose Florida, and he won it twice. So there's a big ground operation that Clinton has in South. She's got 57 field offices in South Florida, and Trump had less than 5 last time I checked. So this is great, and the polling is all good. But I'm just, as a practical matter, Florida is such a diverse state that I would be surprised. I could be totally wrong. I mean, we've elected Rick Scott twice. Yeah. I mean, we have really
Republican governor, for people who are not paying attention.
Republican governor, Tea Party guy.
Very unpopular right now in the polling in Florida.
He's always been unpopular. He barely won re-election because the Democrats picked a guy that couldn't win. And you know, this is the guy that will not allow even the phrase climate change or global warming to be used by any of his staff by the Department of Environmental Regulation. Even as our sea levels are rising, parts of Miami Beach go underwater, parts of Fort Lauderdale, A1A and Fort Lauderdale go underwater on certain times. He will not allow it to be used in any official state correspondence. This is where he's coming from.
You know, it's interesting you mention that, because I would think that's a theme that we're going to see emerge more in Carl Hiaasen novels coming up, your state starting to go underwater.
Yeah, because it changes everything. As I mentioned before, we're all about real estate. And we're all about selling tourism. And if your beaches are now the hotel lobby is now underwater, people are probably not going to check into that particular hotel. And I mean, I make reference to that in Razor
right.
Girl too. And but we have this sort of arrogance as a species that we think we can manage nature, that anything nature throws at us, we can handle. You know, we can figure out a way to, if we can stop erosion, if we can just stop beach erosion, we'll be fine. Well, we can't. This is like the Zika mosquitoes. Oh, if we can contain them to this one little neighborhood, see the map? That's where they are. And they obviously mosquitoes read street signs, and they'll never go north of here, and they'll never go because they're smart mosquitoes. I mean, but we have this arrogance that don't worry. It's all under control.
You wrote a very funny column about Rick Scott's approach to dealing with Zika recently.
Yeah.
Could you share just a couple
well,
of
them? Well, a couple of them. I mean, he was going around the state. It was his master plan to get rid of Zika, and it starts with he does these roundtables, and he goes to his communities all around to reassure the public. And they don't have roundtables. They're all these long tables. And he only puts enough chairs there so that, you know, make sure Marco Rubio doesn't show up and steal his thunder. But it's all about the PR, and it was poking fun at him. I mean, of course, because the idea that you can have a governor saying, "Don't, all is well, it's under control," and then of course 2 days later they're on South Beach, and this is the nightmare of Florida tourism, of all the places to go. South Beach, which, but the good news is they were already handing out condoms on South Beach, so they just had to double up on the supply. I tell people, Zika's terrible, but there's actually worse diseases you can get on South Beach. So.
You are the home of a guy who I think right now is arguably the most transparently ambitious politician in the country. You know exactly who I'm talking about. You mentioned him already, Marco Rubio.
Oh, yeah. He's classic. This is a guy who said he hated the Senate, didn't want to be there anymore. That's why he's running for president. It's ineffective. It's gridlocked. And he's done. And he gets trounced. He won one county in Florida during the GOP. One. And yet he was persuaded to run again for Senate. He is supporting Donald Trump, who humiliated him, who emasculated him, basically, on national television. And when he was asked, he said, this is classic Marco, because he wants it both ways. He said, well, you called him a con man. Do you retract that statement? He goes, no, I don't. But we should vote for him anyway. Basically, that's what he said. Yes, he's a con man, but we should vote for him anyway. Now, this is what passes for patriotism right now in that wing of the party. You dislike Hillary so much that you're willing to turn over the country to a con man. And this is Marco's position. And then the other position he's taken, you're going to love this, Bill, is that, well, I can do more to, if we have him in office, we're going to need people like me to stand up to him in the Senate. He has stood up to nobody in the Senate. He's been an empty suit, an empty desk in the Senate. He needs Google Maps to find his way to the Senate office building. The guy is such a no-show.
As we close, I just do want to tell people that we're going to post on our website at gpb.org/TWS. First of all, we're going to post pictures of the giant Gambian
pouched rat.
Oh, you
got to do that. Yeah.
We'll post information about your new book, Razor Girl.
Yeah, it'll scare people with the...
We'll probably post the keysnews.com story about Megan Mariah Barnes, who was the inspiration for your
thing.
Girl.
Poor thing, yeah.
Carl, thanks so much.
Thanks for having
me
back. It's fun as always.
In December 1987, a headline in Rolling Stone magazine read, REM, America's best rock and roll band. To that, REM drummer Bill Berry replied, we're not the best rock and roll band in America, Pylon is. From 1980 to 83, the Athens-based Pylon toured with the B-52s, REM, the Talking Heads, and U2. And then, at the height of it all, they broke up. But they're back on the scene, thanks to the release of a recording of their farewell show. Senior producer Jenny Ahmed talked with the members of Pylon about their career.
Selling out was the big thing that everybody's worried about. Selling out seemed to be a fate that you had to avoid because it was like gravity. It was something that would just, if you weren't paying attention, you would accidentally sell out. Yeah, I mean, it was a real danger to sell out. And I never could figure out who you sold out to and how much they were paying. I looked, but I didn't see them. But I remember we put out our very first single, a big hole 45. And it was it. Tom Smith accused us of selling out. You guys sold out because we made a record. I said, well, there it is. It finally happened. We sold out.
So you guys were like, cool. You were like, oh, I
No, we were
you know.
Principled. There's a difference.
Okay. Yeah.
We were a little bit too cool.
Thank you.
it started looking like real work at some point. We were like, geez, this is like a lot of work. Let's get out of this.
I think that we got the kind of fame that we were interested in as well. I mean, when we started out, we were fairly clear-eyed about how the kind of music and the kind of band we were wasn't going to wear real well in the smaller markets. I mean, we went straight to big cities and played our shows there.
Well, there was a time that we really were pretty much more experimental. I mean, my real lament looking back is that we never recorded Oatmeal Cookies, which was one of my favorite songs.
Well, they're cooking.
Oh, cooking from the inside out.
That's the best.
It really was art rock at the time, with emphasis on art and less on rock.
Well, we had been told that when you put food in a microwave oven, and those were new at the time, that the food starts cooking in the middle of the food and then heats towards the outside.
These are the kinds of things that fascinated us. It is amazing. One of the things I think that holds a family together or a group like us is, first off, very distinct personalities, and then second off, a respect for that. Still being in the same van together for weeks and months on end, we just kind of established some ground. The van ground rules, one of the best ones was no singing to your Walkman.
Also, the driver gets to decide whether there's music playing or not, and if there is, what music was going to play.
Yeah, and I would stay up with Curtis and talk to him. I remember driving through Texas listening to Remain in Light, I think, twice on a row. And then the sun's coming up. You know, it was amazing.
I remember driving with everybody else was asleep, and I was, at least for part of the time that I was driving through Death Valley at about 1 in the morning, and I was having a hard time staying awake because it was hot and there was no air conditioning. And so I was playing Kraftwerk Computer World really loud and using ice cubes to drip on my neck and stuff to try to wake me up.
We had actually stopped on the other side of Death Valley, and we had pulled up at this like service station. We're like, where's the motel around here? We're just dead. We've got to go to sleep. And the guy pointed down the road and he goes, you need to keep driving. You need to drive through the night. Because tomorrow it's going to be 129 degrees or something. And so that's why Michael had to drive.
You got back together between, you said, 89 and 92. And it kind of seems like this is the time that maybe you could make a lot of, like, oh, you're seeing all these people get popular, and then you're getting back together right during that time. And you went on tour with REM during the Green thing, which was, like, their huge thing. And, like, that whole thing about selling out, like, it seems like you were like, wait.
You know, we like playing. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun to play. Mm-hmm. Live and go out on tour and see friends and people and travel. I love all that. All of that we loved. Mm-hmm. So we thought, why can't we do this and get paid to do it like everybody else that we know does? We tried to sell out. It's not as easy as it seems.
They weren't buying it, you know. So
actually, for 1 year, I put on my tax forms at my accountant said, "Don't do it. Don't put down musician as occupation." And I said, Harold, I have to do this. I've always wanted to be a professional musician. And so for 1 year, I was a professional musician.
Congratulations.
How does money work with you guys? Are you, for this new thing, are you like, oh, we're going to get paid for this finally? Or when REM covered your songs, did you get paid for that? Or
releasing a record at our level, this is not a money-making venture. If we want money, we need to get it from Lexus and have a song in a car commercial, for instance, you know?
Did you guys get money for that? I saw that.
Yeah, we better. I mean, it's not exactly my favorite commercial.
They used Cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or did they use...
It was, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, okay.
No, listen, none of us are going to go out and buy a new Lexus with the check they send us. I used to get checks in the mail from... like BMI or Bug Music, and I used to joke with people and say, as soon as it gets to be less than the postage, I'm going to frame it. But up until that point, I'll cash it. So these checks would come in for, you know, like $3 and $5. So those are the kinds of checks we get. Every now and then you get something with substance to it, but not much, you know.
And you don't know where it's going to come from. We had a song in a movie called Motherhood that Uma Thurman actually dances to a pylon song in it.
Mention the name, even.
If it's played overseas or on Showtime or something, that we get a small royalty check every time it's played.
So einfach und elementar. Das ist Pylon.
Machen Sie lauter!
Nein. Der Mieter unter mir hat so ein ekelhaftes Teil. Damit schlägt er immer gegen die Rohre.
Was soll's?
Vanessa Briscoe-Hay, Michael Lachowski, and Curtis Crow all live in Athens. In February 2009, guitarist Randy Booley died. Pylon released Pylon Live in July, 33 years after their first breakup, on what would have been Randy's 61st birthday. Before we leave you today, I want to remind you of two shows we're taping in front of live audiences in the next couple of weeks. On Tuesday evening, October 4th, we'll be at the Carter Presidential Library. I'll be talking with author Kay Mishu about her new book on President Franklin Roosevelt's years in Georgia. We start at 7 and would love to see you there. Then, on Friday, October 14th, I'll record a conversation with the renowned Atlanta chef Asha Gomez. Her new cookbook, My Two Souths, is about to be released. Asha's cooking for a reception we'll have after our conversation. Seating is very limited, so if you want to attend, go to gpb.org/Asha, A-S-H-A, to make a reservation. We start that night at 7. That's it for this week's show. Our tremendously talented producer is Trevor Young. Our simply sensational senior producer is Jenny Amond. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.